Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, chapter 26. Looks like we're up to text 12. And it hasn't been written up, so I'll just chant it and read the translation of the purport. Evam eva maharodava yatra nipatitam purusham kravyada nama uravastam kravyena gatayantiya kevalam deham barara evam thus eva certainly maharodava the hell known as maharodava yatra where nipatitam being thrown purusham a person Kravyada nama, named Kravyada. Rurava, the Ruru animals. Tam, him, the condemned person. Kravyena, for eating his flesh. Gatayanti, kill. Ya, who? Kevalam, only. Dehambara, intent upon maintaining his own body. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Punishment in the hell called Maharodava is compulsory for a person who maintains his own body by hurting others. In this hell, Ruru animals known as Kravyada torment him and eat his flesh. Purport. The animalistic person who lives simply in the bodily concept of life is not excused. He is put into the hell known as Maharodava and attacked by Ruru animals known as Kravyadas. So, before I deal with this purport, I just want to say something in relation to something I heard this morning during the morning announcement. Worldwide there's a phenomena, it's just something that happens. Sometimes a cow will get bit in the milk bag by a snake. And if that snake happens to be a poisonous snake, that milk will become poisonous milk. And if somebody drinks that milk, they will die. Or they'll have to be seriously poisoned, and that will be in definite difficulty. So, a Vaishnava mukod girnam putam harikatam ritam shravanam naiva kartavyam sarpochista yatapaya. There's a verse in the Vedic literatures that goes that one should not hear from a non-Vaishnava, a Vaishnava, mukod girnam, puta harikatam ritam. Shravanam na kartavyam, never do that. Sarpo chista, it's like doing that, it's like taking the remnants of the poisonous snake. Sarpo chista yatapaya. Milk, ordinarily, it's very nice, very nutritious, very tasteful, but when it has the poison of the snake in there, and you drink it, it's deadly. So in the same way, Krishna Katha is very nice, even the Hare Krishna mantra, very nice. But when you're hearing it from the lips of the serpent, from you hearing it from somebody who's not a Vaishnav, who's contaminated by all sorts of Mayavadi philosophy and all sorts of offenses, then what to speak of being beneficial to your spiritual life, it's going to be just the opposite, extremely detrimental, if not deadly. So, just a word of caution to everybody, because Archita mentioned this morning that at this particular place, the Bhakti Fest, it's one thing for the devotees to go there to preach, You know, because Devotee was there for the purpose of preaching, and then Radhanath Maharaj was there for the purpose of preaching. But if devotees are going there for the purpose of enhancing their spiritual life, be careful. Because there's a lot of people there who have nothing to do with spiritual life. They're like wolves in sheep's clothing. You know, they might be masquerading around as if they're spiritual, but it's nothing to do. It's the opposite of spirituality. I was very shocked to hear that person could be so audacious as to make that a comment, you know. But was even more shocking was to hear Archita make that comment that some people of devotees of ISKCON were there and they were appreciating what he said. They were applauding that. Wake up, put the thinking caps on. It's obviously what he was, you know, where he was coming from in making a remark like that, and what to speak of being appreciated. That should, you know, devotees should walk up and get out if somebody's saying something like that. Because it would be better if we could do something else. But that's the least of the, you know, when you hear somebody blaspheme against your guru or pure devotee, you have this one of three alternatives you can take. You can cut out the person's tongue, basically killing them. Defeat them by argument. If you can defeat them, that's also acceptable. Or if you can't do either one of those two things, get out of there as quickly as you possibly can. Otherwise, you're implicated. You're going to be affected by hearing that person's offense. So that's on that point. Getting to today's purport, Prabhupada here is talking about, the verse and both the purport are talking about how people who maintain their own body by hurting others, that they will not be excused, and they'll have to go to the hell known as Maharorava and attacked by ruru animals known as Kravyadas. So that refers to a lot of people. There are a lot of people in that category who are maintaining their own body maintaining their own body by hurting others. That's like, we're talking about a vast majority of human society. Now, somebody might say, well, I mean, most people aren't killing animals. I mean, most people, they're not actually, you know, the perpetrators of the crime, so to speak. They're not actually putting the knife or putting the axe or whatever however they kill them to the animal. But it doesn't work like that. You know, you're implicated, you're involved in sinful activity, even if you're not the one who's directly killing the animal. It's explained in the Vedic literatures that there's a group of other people that share that sinful activity. You know, for instance, say you're killing an animal, or say you're, with regards to, say, eating of flesh. It's not only the person who kills the animal that is sinful, it's the person who transports that animal, the person who sells that dead flesh, the person who consumes that dead flesh, and there might be a few others too that I'm missing. Yeah, one who raises it for slaughter, one who cooks it, you know, all these different types of things. You're implicated there in the sinful reaction. And Prabhupada would give this analogy. I'm not sure if Prabhupada gave this analogy, but I've heard many devotees give it many, many times. Say somebody robs a bank, and you drive the getaway car. You're what's called an accomplice to the crime, and you're also, guilty. And you know it's a criminal offense, and you're going to be punishable. You'll also be put in jail. You're an accomplice to the crime. So unfortunately, the vast majority of human society, they're an accomplice to the crime of maintaining their body by hurting others, specifically referring to innocent animals here. And this is going on in such like astronomical proportions today throughout the world. I mean, like hundreds of millions of innocent animals are cruelly practically tortured throughout their entire life and then slaughtered in a no less cruel and inhumane way. And this is, you know, throughout the entire world, and this is going on. So that they're going to be accountable. All these people are accountable for that. Another very unfortunate thing is it's actually something that's supported by quote-unquote mainstream religions in the world. That's very unfortunate. because it's further misleading. It's kind of like, you know, people, even their so-called organizations or institutions that they're looking to for guidance, spiritual guidance in life, they're giving them the wrong information. They're teaching them the wrong thing. Rather than teaching them how to be pious and get purified, they're teaching them how to become more sinful and, you know, accelerating their path to hell. It's very unfortunate. But this is, it's not shocking though. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's explained, I think it's in the 18th chapter, there's this verse about religion and different modes of nature. So it talks about how religion and the mode of ignorance, or maybe it's knowledge and the mode of ignorance, it takes, you know, it has everything in the opposite. You know, it sees a saintly person as a very like ordinary mundane person. It has somebody who's very degraded, it sees them as very saintly. It's like that. It's reversed. Everything's like, so that's Kali Yuga, is religion's in the mode of ignorance. And as a result, people are becoming further confused and degraded. And Prabhupada commented about this specifically on different occasions. I found this, I've read this before, but it's been a long time since I have, so I'll read it again. This is an excerpt from a conversation, morning walk conversation Prabhupada had right here in Los Angeles in 1973, right down there in Venice Beach. This subject came up. And about, you know, religions misleading people because they're not on the transcendental platform. And Prabhupada had, anyway, this to say about that. He said, scriptures must be transcendental. Nonsense scripture and people become nonsense. So accept Vedic literature, all nonsense scripture. They are not scripture. Manufactured. The Bible was manufactured by the saint, according to their imagination. It was not spoken by Lord Jesus Christ. What was spoken by Jesus Christ, that they ignore. Thou shalt not kill. And that's why I'm reading it now, because Prabhupada specifically, you know, thou shalt not kill. They kill. Nobody is following Christian principle. Neither Bible is perfect. But that, if we say, we shall be shot. So Prabhupada said that in 1973 here in Los Angeles. And he specifically makes this point that Jesus Christ said, thou shalt not kill. Sometimes Christians might come back and they might say, well, that's just, you know, referring to human beings. And Prabhupada's response to that is, that's your interpretation. You know, the word kill is clear. Kill refers to all living creatures. So unfortunately, these people are even being misled by the religious traditions that they're taking shelter of, and rather than getting purified, they're actually being assisted in their progressive march towards hell. Very unfortunate. Of course, that's where we come into the picture. You know, we have to try to, Prabhupada said, we have to try to make these unfortunate people fortunate. And you know, it's easier said than done. It's easier said than done. It's a lot of hard work, because people are just really confused and ignorant. Like, you know, when we try to preach to people about the AB, what Prabhupada would refer to as the ABC of spiritual life, we're not the body, right? Then people, they just take that and says, that's just you. You guys believe that. That's just your blind faith. You know, that's the accusation that's generally leveled against people, religious people in general, and we're get included, you know. We get lumped in there with them. Just that's your blind faith. Actually, a lot of the things we believe, it's not our blind faith that we believe them. It's your blind ignorance. It's your blind doubt that you don't believe it. It's just your blind doubt. You see, like, say I walk up to some person on a college campus, just some kid. I talk to him, explain to him, show him the picture. See, this body's always changing, but it's showing how the spiritual essence remains the same. It's actually eternal. It continues even after the body's finished. It existed before the body began. And they'll, with great conviction, with great confidence, they'll come back and say, that's just your faith. That's just blind faith. Well, actually, no. It's just your blind doubt that you don't accept that. Now, why? Why am I saying that? Blind doubt. Because there is information out there to support that. You see? But because you, Mr., person I'm talking to, you're not educated. You're not educated. So you're not even aware of it. What to speak of accepting, you're not even aware of it. And I'll give you an example. For the last few days I've been reading this book that was written by Dave Amritamaraj, Searching for Vedic India. Wonderful book, incredible book. Every devotee should read this book. It's fabulous. And I found this really interesting section. He was talking about the work of this Ian Stevenson. I've mentioned him in class a few times. But he, and just really briefly, this is a man, he studied these phenomena of children who, when they hit 2 and 3 years old, they start talking about a previous lifetime, the person they remember being in a past life. And they can verify it. They'll take them to the place where supposedly they live, and they take them to the general vicinity, and they can just, like, get out, and they can walk right to the house where they live, walking through many neighborhoods with many, having to do many turns in the streets and this and that, and they can go and identify the, people, mother, father, brothers and sisters, husbands and wives like that, from a previous family, and show where they, the room where they live, and they all sorts of verifiable details. They're able to provide that kind of information. So anyway, and he's done this. He's investigated over on the whole 2,500 cases, and of those, I think it's about 67 or 68 were very comprehensively researched, and he wrote about those. So anyway, in his book, Dave Amritamaraj mentions though Stevenson's work shakes the foundations of modern science, the care and precision of his research have brought him accolades from the most conservative sectors of the scholarly world. Prestigious scientific periodicals such as the American Journal of Psychiatry, the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, and the International Journal of Comparative Sociology publish his findings. So he's been published in these mainstream journals like that. It says, even the American Medical Association, unchallengeable in size, influence, and tradition, officially stated in its journal that Stevenson had, and this is quote now, painstakingly and unemotionally collected a detailed series of cases in which the evidence for reincarnation is difficult to understand on any other grounds, which is just another way of saying it's difficult to understand. It's just difficult to understand without going to the explanation of reincarnation. It's difficult to understand on any other grounds. He has placed on record a large amount of data that cannot be ignored. That's a quote from the American Medical Association. So, basically they're saying in so many words that, hey, there's something to this. And that's saying something. The American Medical Association is a very conservative body. And as Maharaj points out here, that they're unchallengeable in their influence, size, influence, and tradition. So, when we present to somebody, as an example, you're presenting to somebody, we're not the body, and the soul's eternal, and if they come back with, that's just your blind faith, then you can just pull something like this up. Oh, yeah? Well, if it's just blind faith, how come, the soul, there is a soul and that's going from one body to the other? How come the American Medical Association is saying this about the research of this man, Ian Stevenson? Anyway, it's just something to use for preaching. Another example of this is you might get somebody. I've had this happen a couple times. Somebody who's read the Bhagavad Gita, and they'll point out that this stuff is really far out. I mean, you have this Krishna speaking to the sun god Vivaswan. You think there's people on the sun? Do you guys believe there's people on the sun? Come on, get real. People on the sun? Why not? There can be people on the sun. Elsewhere in that book, I was reading, Maharaj was referring to some scientific research where scientists have, they're doing research in, how creatures living in all sorts of what we would consider very alien environments. And they found creatures, they call them extremophiles. Extremophiles. That's the name for the broad category. And then there's thermophiles, hyperthermophiles, they're living entities that can exist in very high temperature. And I can't remember the name for the ones that can live in the very low temperatures. But anyway, they found that there's living entities that can live in 100 degrees Celsius. That's 212 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the temperature at which water boils. And they're doing great. Matter of fact, when it's night, when it goes down to 90 degrees Celsius, they feel cold. They can't breed. they breed when it's 100 degrees Celsius, 212 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, and they found living entities, and these living entities were found 2 miles under the surface of the Earth, right? And then they found living entities 12 miles under the Antarctic ice cap. You know, when they do research down in Antarctica, 12 miles below, there's living entities. There's, you know, creatures living. And they found living entities down on the ocean floor. They found living entities that there's no way they have oxygen or sunlight. And so they must be breathing something else, or you know, they have another way, so somehow or another. So this supports the idea, which, you know, Prabhupada would make every now and then, that sarvagata, the living entities can exist, and they're all pervading. Sarvagata means all pervading, and they can exist in all sorts of different conditions. You know, there are living entities that have bodies suitable for living in environments of predominantly earth, predominantly water, predominantly fire, you know, the sun, predominantly air, and predominantly ether. See, living entities are all over the place. They have bodies that are capable of allowing them to live in, you know, environments that are totally different than the environment we live in, like that. So, yeah. And as the point I'm making is that there is evidence. There's evidence to support this worldview. Extremophiles. It supports the idea that, you know, we say there's life on other planets. People might laugh, but it's not just these are examples of how life can exist in atmospheres which, you know, seem extremely foreign and alien to us, but they exist and they thrive there. Another thing is, like, somebody might say, well, you know, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to the sun god. It's talking about, like it says here in this what it's called the purport, that it happened hundreds of millions of years ago. There's no people hundreds of millions of years ago. Well, our very own Judhakarma spent 9 years researching the entire fossil record. This is significant if you stop and think about it. The whole science of archaeology and archaeology anyway, is only 150, 200 years old. The whole thing. So Judhakarma, before he wrote that book, he researched all the digs. You know, he went right back from the beginning. He read all the reports. He researched the entire history of that particular science. And what they found was there were just as many high quality reports of findings of, you know, human bones and artifacts in stratas of the earth, which indicated that they were not tens and thousands of years old, but sometimes hundreds of millions of years old. There were many good quality reports that were reporting that, as there were reports reporting the other thing, you know, that, you know, human beings are only in the stratus that indicate, you know, up to maximum 50,000 years old. So, you know, his point is, well, why these reports? Why do you accept these reports and not those reports? And that's who you refer to as the knowledge filter. So, but the point is, the evidence is there. The evidence is there for anatomically modern human beings going back hundreds of millions of years. But for some reason or another, it's not the popular evidence. It's not the popular way of, you know, thinking about the whole thing. But it's there, and that was his book. That's that book, Forbidden Archaeology. So it supports that. So anyway, so we have a lot of ammunition. You know, we have nothing to be, what's the word? Not scared of, but we, you know, there's no reason for us to feel like insecure about what we're trying to present, because, on every different level, it's very solid, and you know, there is even a lot of empiric or, you know, material kind of evidence out there that validates our worldview, and so we should, with great conviction and enthusiasm, go out there and try to present this to other people, share it. But at the same time, not be discouraged. Like say an interesting, because people have their free will. But like, once again, Prabhupada said, we have to try to make the unfortunate fortunate. That's the meaning of preaching. And you know, even sometimes we're presenting things very nicely and very, you know, boldly, but you know, we don't have control of whether people are going to accept it. And I'll give you an interesting example about how people have free will, and Krishna protects people's free will. I have a cousin. He's retired now. For his working career, he was the person in charge of a research laboratory at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, or Urbana, Illinois. So last year he visited me here, and he came with his son, and we were talking in the restaurant. We were taking prasadam in the restaurant, and I was trying to the best I could, somehow present something about Krishna consciousness to him, you know, but without kind of looking stupid or anything. I mean, he's kind of, you know, as I said, he worked with PhD students who were doing research, and he was the person who kind of ran the lab. And so anyway, I don't know. I can't remember even how I approached it. But somehow or other, at some point, the conversation came around to out-of-body experiences, and I was trying to use that, and I thought, oh, I'm getting it over my head here. I started feeling uncomfortable. I was going to make a fool out of myself, you know. But anyway, interestingly enough, he chimed in. He said, actually, he had one. He had an out-of-body experience. I said, huh? And his son was surprised too, because his son never heard him talk about it either. He said, yeah. And this guy's as straight as a pin. I mean, he's as straight as a pin. So like, if he says it, it's like, yeah, definitely, this is. I mean, he's not going to say anything to impress it, you know, nothing like that. So he's describing, yeah, he was in, it was either Belgium or Denmark. I think it was Denmark. And he was running. He was a runner. That was his habit. So he was running through the park, and, you know, on a morning run like that. And then just at one point, boop, he saw himself. He was like about 50 feet above the ground. And there he was, watching himself running. And he said it lasted for a few minutes. And then, you know, there he was, back in his body again. But he remembers watching, and you know, I said, how'd you feel? He said, very peaceful, very, you know. He described like a lot of the different things people describe when they have an out-of-body experience. And, you know, so then I said, well, what do you think? I mean, doesn't that, you know, indicate to you that there's something more than, with something more than just this material body, that there's like a spiritual dimension to life? And he said, well, you know, not necessarily. It could be something, you know, something that the brain does. And, you know, he's very... And I gave him a Bhagavad Gita, and I also gave him one of these books by Ian Stevenson, which, you know, talks about evidence for reincarnation. I gave him, but you know, he's the same. He's a very nice fellow. If you met him, you'd like him, because you know, very well mannered and soft spoken and like that. But it just doesn't want spiritual life, you know. So Krishna protects that free will. You know, and it's like Krishna's not going to force anybody to get spiritual. I mean, even somebody has, you know, that type of an experience for themselves. But for him, you know, I would have thought that for somebody that would have been like a real catalyst, a real impetus to get spiritual. But he just took it. He explained it in a different way to himself. You know, he had came up with a different explanation for it, some other interpretation, and he's just continuing on his merry way and just, you know, material life like that. So people have their free will. And this is Kali Yuga, as Judhakarma pointed out in classes he's given, that Kali Yuga is a special facility for people who want to enjoy unrestricted sense gratification. You see, so, you know, on the one hand, that's there. There's people who here, they just want unrestricted sense gratification. So Krishna's, he doesn't force it, spiritual life. But to speak of force spiritual life on people, is that verse, if somebody knows it, they could help me out. Even if you know, it's not that you even have to be, you have to really want it. You know, there's that verse, Tatra Lolam Ekam, I can't remember the Sanskrit, but, you know, Rupa Goswami says, what is the price of, you know, to get devotional service? And he says, actually, there's only one price, you know, that intense greed, intense desire for it. You know, so what to speak of force it on people, Krishna won't award us devotional service unless we really want it. So, you know, and that's not, to develop that type of desire is not easy. So anyway, but still, nevertheless, we have to you know, try to make the unfortunate fortunate by preaching enthusiastically. And what if they take, wonderful. You know, if people become devotees, wonderful. I think as I read in a previous class, but, you know, that's not our duty, you know, to see necessarily that they have become devotees. Our duty is just to go and speak, you know, present the philosophy to them, give them the opportunity. If they take and they, you know, they appreciate it, wonderful. We're happy. You know, and we'll try for that. But if they don't, that's not our, we haven't failed. You know, we haven't failed. We've succeeded. Because why? Because we've executed the instruction of the spiritual master. And just by executing the instruction of the spiritual master, we're successful. You know, Prabhupada on several occasions said to be very quickly recognized by Krishna, preaching is the shortcut process. So if we just go and make that effort, you know, to present the philosophy, give people an opportunity to engage in devotional service by taking a book, you know, chanting, taking prasadam, we were successful just in that attempt. And so we have nothing to lose, but everything to gain. And they have something to gain. You know, they can gain Krishna consciousness. We can't lose anything, and we just benefit. And we can simultaneously help these people in the process. What time is it? 10 after. Okay, so that's the time it says here to stop. Yeah, Archie DeBoo.
One is the verse you were trying to remember from Bhagavad Gita is the 18th chapter, it's 1831. Yaya dharmam adharmam cha. Where Krishna says, that understanding which cannot distinguish between religion and irreligion, between action that should be done and action that should not be done, is in the mode of passion, not ignorance. So I would add to that, that anybody who can't distinguish between who's a guru and who's not a guru is also at best in the mode of passion. So since we're all together and we heard this, you know, this comment this morning, I think we should discuss a little bit. What are the points this person is making? And, you know, because we're not just, you know, telling, blasting them. We're saying that you're actually incorrect in your understanding. So he's glorifying his so-called guru because, one, he didn't write any books. So therefore it's glorious. The majority of people in the world haven't written any books. Are they all glorious? You know, I mean, let's look at it factually. He's glorifying his so-called guru because his guru didn't open any temples. The majority of people in the world haven't opened any temples. Are they all glorious? He's glorifying his so-called guru because he didn't make any disciples. The majority of people in the world have not made any disciples. Does that make them all glorious? So, I mean, his points are just foolish. They're just actually foolish statements. Somebody's glorious because, A, they didn't write any books. Most of us haven't written any books. Does that make us glorious? I mean, it's just not factual stuff that he's saying. Then the other 2 points he made was, well, this so-called personality was in the Himalayas, high up in the Himalayas. Yeah. There are many people who live high up in the Himalayas. Are they all gurus or glorious because they live there?
Yeah, and the bottom line is, what is the result of their sunbathing? You know, he made the point, he just shone like the sun and we bathe in his sunlight or something like that. So what is the result, Palena Padichite, what is the result of your sunbathing? What qualities do you have now? You know, what spiritual qualities have you imbibed or developed or manifesting as a result of his association? How are you any more, you know, how are you a more spiritual person? We don't see it. But, you know, what is the evidence of your spirituality as a result of having associated with him?
So like you were saying, the most shocking thing is that devotees who are supposedly followers of Srila Prabhupada applaud this kind of stuff. They're just not thinking. Prabhupada was not impressed if we didn't understand the philosophy. Chiru Kramaraj told a story. I was there when he was telling it that once after an evening program where Prabhupada was really smashing in person and all that. So the next day when he was giving a massage, he was glorifying Prabhupada. You know, from behind him he was giving a massage. He was going, oh, Prabhupada, you were preaching so strongly last night. Prabhupada listened for a while and he said, the best way to glorify me is that you should learn and preach like I'm preaching. That's the best way to glorify me. So it's all of our duty to really, really understand the philosophy. If you really understand the philosophy, or you're trying hard to understand it, you're not impressed by these kind of stupid statements. My guru is glorious because he didn't write any books. I mean, come on. How does that make somebody glorious by not writing any books? You know, it's just foolish. It's a foolish statement. So we really need to listen carefully when people speak, understand it through our shastra, and then we can see when they're making a factual statement or not a factual statement, something that's really
shastra chakshu,
intelligent or not intelligent. And then you're not swayed by people when they make these foolish statements.
Yeah, that's that expression, shastra chakshu, see through the eyes of the scripture.
books, we always put a biography of Rupert in the BBC books. And the biography says that he wrote so many books and he opened so many temples. That's why they specifically say these things. They're trying to attack Srila Prabhupada. It's not just some off the, on top of his head statement. They go around saying this all the time because they're trying to attack Prabhupada and ISKCON. And then the devotees nowadays, they're foolishly thinking, well, these people are so popular in the kirtan and bhajan world, so we have to accommodate. No! Kirtan and bhajan was started in America and practically around the world by Srila Prabhupada. They're jumping on our bandwagon. We're not jumping on their bandwagon. It's foolish to think that we need these people. We don't need them. We don't need them. Prabhupada used to say, we're handing out diamonds here, so you can't expect that everybody's going to be attracted. Most people go to Big Lots and Target and Walmart. They don't shop in Tiffany's. But Tiffany's is not going to go out of business just because the massive people don't go there. They don't care. They have a product that those who appreciate and are qualified to buy will come and buy. So we're the same way. We're in an organization that have the real knowledge. And not everybody's going to appreciate that, but those who appreciate, that's fine. If it's only a handful, that's okay. Prabhupada was satisfied with that. He's not trying to sway the whole world he's not going to change the philosophy to sway the whole world. He's going to present it as it is. And if you're attracted, that's good for you. If you're not, that's okay.
Anybody else have any? Yeah. I'm going to talk to Prabhu.
Yeah, thank you also for this, for making that preface. It's an important point. And it seems like it's not necessarily unrelated to these verses. I've been noticing the last couple of verses, we're talking about Rarava and Maharava as this place where persons go who harm others in order to live. And it seems strongly implied, at least, that it's from eating animals that one goes to these places, but it doesn't seem to be necessarily limited to that. And so I was wondering if you just wanted to elaborate a little bit on that. What's your understanding?
Well, just this morning I was flipping through my bookshelf there and I saw Raja Vidya and I pulled it down and I thought I remembered a place in where Prabhupada made some comment that I was fond of quoting every now and then. Fortunately, I had a bookmark on the right of that page and Prabhupada said, this material world is being managed by Rakshasas, man-eating demons who will, he said, eat their own sons for the satisfaction of their senses. And then the next sentence was something that there are big regimes throughout the world now, where people are being sacrificed for the satisfaction of the senses of the Rakshasas. So in other words, I think maybe that comes in that category too, that there are very powerful people who are in control. And, they know how to do business. They know how to, manage and manipulate the resources in the material world in such a way that they can become very wealthy and comfortable, and they don't care if it means exploiting a lot of people, what's involved in the process of them becoming wealthy and comfortable, that a lot of people work like slaves practically, or animals, and are suffering and are subjected to unhealthy conditions, and this has been going on right through history. The people have big factories. If it wasn't for unions, they don't care what the health conditions are. The people could be working in the dark and the damp and so that's going on. I think maybe that's referring to that, powerful people who are not, getting the benefit of other people's hard work and labor and everything like that. And they're paying them something, but not fairly, perhaps. But they're mostly benefiting their sense gratification and not concerned at all. And they're also, people, they're living and they're maintaining their own body, but they're hurting others. They could do otherwise. They have the human beings, they have the conscience, they have enough intelligence to understand what they're doing, but they don't care. You see? So those people will suffer too. They'll be punished too, I think. I think that includes them as well. Is that kind of along the lines of what you were thinking? Yeah. Okay, if anybody wants, I have a bunch of these printed out, that statement about, how the scriptures must be transcendental. If anybody would like a copy of that, I've got about a dozen of them here. You can grab one. Okay, thank you very much. Gantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah.